go to Jerry, first-time caller from Los Angeles. Jerry, you're on KFI.
Hi, Bill. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
The thing that I just don't seem to understand, it seems to be a pretty much common-sense issue with the Simon Wiesenthal Temple not wanting to debate them. First of all, I don't think the rabbi wanted to give them any more glory. I think, first of all, it sounds to me, and I wanted to ask Mark, as his background, he mentions quite a few times the movement, quote, the movement. Does that mean, when you say movement, does that make it a Nazi movement? Is that your expression when you're referring to Nazi movement?
No, by no means. In fact, interestingly enough, in France, Holocaust revisionism has been characterized as a leftist movement. I use the word movement loosely. It's not a very good movement. The pioneer of Holocaust revisionism was a Frenchman, Paul Rossigny, who was himself an internee, a concentration camp inmate at Buchenwald and Dora during the Second World War. He was a socialist, a member of the French National Assembly, and decorated by the French government for his resistance activities.
Before we built up the gentleman, I just want to move on because I don't think that's too relevant. But because you mentioned movement so many times, I was insinuating myself that you meant the Nazi movement.
No, of course not.
I wanted to clarify without getting this other gentleman's credibilities forward. I'm more interested in your credibilities. Now, are you currently a member of the Nazi Party?
No, I've never been a Nazi Party member.
Okay.
The IHR, in fact, has run articles by a number of Jewish writers. The IHR is not the enemy of any ethnic, racial, or religious group. The IHR is a broad base that has no political program and has no political alliance.
Okay. If you're bringing, for instance, Ted was saying that he's doing research and he has this book that he's gathering his facts for and everything's supposed to be brought out to the American people and this is for education, this is your so-called philosophy, this is what I've been ascertaining from listening to from the past hour. But what doesn't make sense is the United States government has sent teams of researchers to different camps in Germany and to many of the camps and sealed these files. And have found different traces of gas, different traces of human, you might say, if someone were to have been dead and cremated in those areas, human excrement in these chambers, and you are referring to that as not possible.
You say the files were sealed, sir. When were they opened?
What are these files?
Those were files that were made public approximately 2 years ago on a I don't know if I could mention the broadcast station, but by a public broadcast, and from that point on, they were deemed not to be public information.
Okay, I know what you're referring to now. You're referring to these documents that came from the Soviet Union, probably, that were made public a couple of years ago, and their copies are now going to be available through the Red Cross in Baltimore. These documents record the deaths of approximately 70 or 74,000 people at Auschwitz. These documents also confirm the deaths of something like 300,000 people in all the concentration camps in Germany during the Second World War. These documents are extremely important. They are not consistent with the Holocaust extermination story.
Then why do they have gas pellet and other chemical traces of such a high nitrate level that could not be used for cleaning clothes or lice or anything?
Well, sir, I don't know quite what you're talking about. The America's foremost expert on gas chambers has investigated the so-called extermination gas chambers at Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Auschwitz-Birkenau. He has concluded, stated under oath, and has written the expert report to the effect that these chambers were not and could not have been used as extermination gas chambers. I don't know what report you're talking about, sir.
Okay, I thought you just said you did. But anyway, my final point, Bill, if I can go on and make one more quick point.
Sure, go ahead.
My parents, as well as probably your parents, I don't have my grandparents either, and there's, hearing these people, I've heard a lot of things come across KFI in the last few years, and this really got my goat to hear these people come on, and I think they're trying to pass themselves off as more as educators, but I think the general public should be aware of that. Just because of their nature of passing off and pondering off questions with such lack of answers, but They're just total...
Sir, in reference to, you know, to the United States government investigation, there was an Allied investigation of gas chamber exterminations at the end of the war. In 1948, the Allied Investigation Commission showed that stories of alleged gassings at Dachau, Buchenwald, and a number of other camps were shown to be false and based primarily on either extorted or testimony under torture or under lies by former inmates.
Okay.
This was a joint Allied investigation commission at the end of the war. They were not permitted to investigate Auschwitz. The Holocaust extermination story we hear today is not the same Holocaust extermination story we heard at the end of the war.
As Bill said, why would so many stories, why would so many people pass along to their children, young, innocent, male and female adults who are coming up into this world, who do not need to hear of death?
Yeah.
Why do the stories get passed along?
I agree with you. And Jerry, let me interrupt. You know, why, you know, my dad telling me the stories of his family and the shootings that he saw. He doesn't have a political agenda here. He's not for the state of Israel.
He's not
looking for reparations. He's telling me historical facts.
No one says that your father is not true.
How about the other stories? The thousands of other stories, though.
Well, many of these stories, I'm sure, are true. One has to distinguish what is one talking about. What is specifically being said in this particular case?
Yeah, but you know, you're missing, Mark. If one story is true, there could be thousands that are true.
There could
be.
Let's prove one story about a gas chamber is true. Let's start with one, and not talk about thousands and tens of thousands.
Sir, another thing. You know, during this Vietnam War, all of us are aware of the terrible atrocity at My Lai, mm-hmm. atrocity of Vietnamese civilians.
Right.
I'm sure other massacres like this took place. That does not mean that there was a policy by the United States government to massacring Vietnamese,
even though
very, very terrible things happened to lots of Vietnamese during the war.
You know what I think you're trying to do? I think you're trying to sidestep the whole issue, and I think that there's still a back of the bus area of people, sort of yourself, that would like all the Jews that are still in existence, that they, in your minds, is transmitted around that none of this happened, and like 20, 30 years from now will go by, there'll be another incident, and people like you don't want to see Israel get its own... I'm sure you want Palestine to get Israel back. Hey,
Jerry, I got to cut you off because we got to take a break, and we'll let the two of you.
All
Jerry,
right,
thanks for the
Bill.
Call. And I'll let Ted and Mark respond to that if you care to when we come back on KFI AM 640. This is Bill Handel. Let's go to Ken Gallagher in the KFI Traffic Center.
We're back at 921, KFI AM 640. Bill Handel, we're talking about... Holocaust revisionism. I'm sitting in for Joe Crummy. By the way, tonight's weather, LA Civic Center, tonight, light winds, lows near the 40. Tomorrow, it's going to be slightly warmer in the high 90s. It's going to be cold in the 40s. Currently, it is clear in 54 in Long Beach, clear in 48 in Van Nuys. Back we go. Our guests, Ted O'Keefe, editor of the Journal Historical Review, Mark Weber, director of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, also involved with the Journal of Historical Review, and we are talking Holocaust revisionism during this hour. Ted, you were about to say before I cut you off before the break.
Okay, yeah. Actually, during the break, Bill, you asked about the unpopularity of Holocaust revisionism.
Right. Yeah, I asked you if you ever got death threats.
We do periodically, but since IHR, the Institute for Historical Review, was founded in 1978, we've had several arson attacks on our headquarters, culminating in the complete destruction of our headquarters and stocks on July 4th, 1984.
You guys still have insurance? Can you get insurance on the building?
We have insurance.
Oh, I'm just wondering how you do that after being burned a few times.
We've had people have fired shots at us. Revisionists have been, as I mentioned earlier, have been subjected to legal persecution. Many countries commonly classed as democracies. Revisionists, Dr. Robert Forson, a French professor who's one of the world's leading Holocaust revisionists, has been attacked several times. The last time he received such a beating, he was in the hospital.
He was almost killed. You act like you're surprised. This is a fairly unpopular position you're taking here.
15 years ago, it was very unpopular to say that. Once again, comparisons may be odious, but it was very unpopular to advocate homosexuality. 25 years ago it was unpopular to advocate long hair. Are you implying that unpopular positions should be...
Well, what's more important is it points up, as you conceded during the break, the more enormous political potency and the emotional nature of this Holocaust issue. And the people who hold this view, people who say the earth is flat or any number of other ideas which are held like Holocaust revisionism to be completely crazy, they're not persecuted in this sort of way. It's just wrong. It points up the enormous political potency of the Holocaust issue and its use in our society.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Guillermo calling from Pasadena for the first time. Guillermo, welcome to KFI.
Oh, hi, thanks. I would like to make a comment.
Please.
I've been listening to the show, and I'm kind of shocked about all these Jews who are calling the program and trying to cut any attempt to discussion or investigation by non-Jews about the Holocaust.
Why are you shocked, Guillermo? What do you want Jews to say?
Well, I'm shocked. I was born in Argentina, and I was raised in Argentina.
Right.
And
don't tell me. You're not Jewish.
Pardon me?
And don't tell me. You're not Jewish.
No, I'm not Jew.
What a shock. I'm surprised. Okay.
Oh, you are surprised.
Completely shocked and amazed.
Pardon me?
Completely shocked and amazed that you're not Jewish, Guillermo. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm Jew, and I'm proud of not being a Jew. But by the way, I don't understand why the non-Jews of America follow the propaganda of the Jews and make a taboo out of this issue. The whole thing is that I believe that Jews use this as a propaganda to collect money for Israel.
All right. That's a point, and thank you for the call. And I will tell you, to a certain extent, the Holocaust is, we were discussing that during the break, is an enormously potent political tool used by Israel, used by organizations like the B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League. I happen to think it's justified, but I don't disagree that it is a very, very potent political tool, and it should be used as such. That's my view. Well, we finally got someone to believe with you guys, all right?
I think it's important to point out that there are facts,
mm-hmm.
and there are factual arguments, and there are emotions. And it's very helpful sometimes to try to dissociate one's emotions from factual discussions. I think, and Mark often points this out, I think it's a big mistake for Jews in America and in Israel and around the world to erect, and part of what Guillermo says is true, there is a taboo to a certain extent about criticizing Jewish issues in America. I think it's a big mistake to equate criticism of specific Jews or Israel or discussion of the Holocaust with some mad desire to want to kill off the Jews, as Jerry, the earlier caller, said.
I think that's the issue. I think we're finding more and more criticism of Israel. I mean, that's legitimate.
Bill, there's another aspect of it, too, and that no matter what, you might say it's legitimate maybe for Jews to do this, but what's not legitimate is for the United States government to become involved in it. What's not legitimate is that this becomes a tool used by our government and by our society. It has a centrality in our society that is entirely illegitimate. It's not right to make the partisan concerns of one group the attempted concerns of everybody in this society.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Kirk, who says he has evidence of the Holocaust. Kirk, you're on KFI.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. You have to speak a little bit up, please.
Sure.
There you go.
I am not a historian, and so I don't have documents in front of me. But I just wanted to point out that, are you gentlemen familiar who Victor Brock was?
Yes.
Brock was a member, for the listeners, Brock was a member of Hitler's chancellery. At Nuremberg, Brock testified that there was no secret that the final solution implied the extermination of Jews.
No, wait a minute. No, every German official who testified at Nuremberg, it's astounding, but...
Gentlemen, been talking, let me just make my case, and then you certainly have an opportunity to speak the rest of the evening.
Fine.
Rudolf Hoss, who was the commandant at Auschwitz for a period, testified that Himmler had told him that first of all, Auschwitz was the site of the extermination of Jews, and that Himmler had chosen it because of its remote location and its close location to the rail system, which facilitated the importation of people for for mass execution.
Right. Can I answer your point now, please?
Well, let me just. I'll
so why don't we go? All right, tell you what,
I'll
Kirk.
Be quick about it. But
right. Let's go through your points, and I'll let Mark go ahead and refute each one.
Look.
The other thing, though, is that in a correspondence in April of 1943, Himmler's secretary wrote that the Führer did not want did not want any published reference to the extermination or to the final solution. That this was supposed to be if you will, a clandestine operation on behalf of the Nazis.
All right.
Now let me just sum up in saying, I have no, you know, in terms of reparations, you know, it is 50 years, and we have to look to the future, you know, and we cannot hang guilt upon a people. And I would also say, though, that I'm very concerned by a comment that one of you gentlemen made much earlier on. That more or less implied that Jews were holding the world hostage because they were using this Holocaust thing and they were getting concessions from the United States government, which I think is ludicrous because, I mean, as a minority, I think that Jews are one of the least favored minorities, although I do accept that Jews entertain a certain amount of business and political power in this country. And have been very successful at using those avenues to promote Jewish causes. And I do have to say that I am also very much ashamed that the Wiesenthal Center did not debate you this evening, because I think the way you bring fact out in history is through open discussion and not through refusing to meet in an open and a fair forum. Finally, I have to say is that I am somewhat concerned that perhaps there are people who are trying to use the Holocaust as a political chip, and I think in doing so, what you're doing is you are weakening the enormity of that crime. And I just want to point out to other KFI listeners that this is an issue that not only affects Jews, but also, you know, there were certain ethnic minorities in Europe that were massacred. There were, you know, the Gypsies. There were other Slavic minorities. Homosexuals, intellectuals,
all right, Kirk,
dissidents.
We got to cut you off. Thank you very much for the call. We're going to have to take a break. We're going to come back, and Mark, we're going to let you refute. I assume you took the notes, and we're going to come back, and we're going to let Mark refute every allegation, every comment that Kirk made. Thanks a lot, Kirk. That was a great call. This is Bill Handel on KFI, filling in for Joe Crummy. Let's go to Ken Gallagher in the KFI News Center. Ken. KFI at 9:33. Bill Handel sitting in for Joe Crummy. Joe is back tomorrow night. Tonight we are discussing Holocaust revisionism with Mark Weber, director for the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, and Ted O'Keefe, who is editor of the Journal of Historical Review, Holocaust Revisionists. Now, before we went to the break, Kirk was on the phone, and he had some pretty powerful statements, and I believe, Mark, you took notes. Would you please refute them, but instead of just arguing, would you please give Kirk's statement and then come back and do a refutation?
Kirk raised a number of points. I mean, okay. He raised very disparate points, but one of them I agree with. He said that the Holocaust is used as a political weapon in our society. I don't think there's any question of that, and we also take the view that that's illegitimate, that's wrong. Specific things he brought up, well, he did mention a 1943 document by Martin Bormann, Hitler's secretary, which did forbid the German press to talk about or speculate about the treatment of the Jews during the war, and that's true. It didn't talk about extermination. That's not true. Kirk mischaracterized that document. What Bormann apparently wanted to do was prevent getting any complex discussion in the German media during the war about what would be the fate of the Jews after the end of the war. But the most important point he probably raised was the so-called confession or testimony of Rudolf Höss, the Auschwitz commandant who claimed at Auschwitz that he was personally responsible for the extermination of 2.5 or 3 million Jews at Auschwitz during the time that he was commandant of that camp. He also made this statement in some very well highly touted statements or affidavits that have been widely quoted ever since. What's important is that we now know that the Hearst confessions were extorted by torture, that he was tortured at the end of the war when he was captured by five British officers. The man who led the torture session, a British military police officer named Bernard Clark, boasted about this later in a memoir, and that no historian now accepts numerous aspects of Hearst's so-called confession. No serious historian, as Aaron Breitbart of the Simon Wiesenthal Center said at the beginning of this program, now accepts that anything like 2.5 million of anybody, Jews or anybody, were killed at Auschwitz during the Second World War. His statement that Hearst's contention that there was a extermination policy begun in 1941, that he was commissioned by Himmler to carry this out, that's now admitted also to be untrue. Anyway, the point is that this Hearst statement is a central pillar of the Holocaust extermination story. It's now discredited. It's now known to be untrue.
All right, let's take another phone call or two. Charlene, calling from Los Angeles. You're on KFI. Hello, Charlene.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
All right, I disagree wholeheartedly with Mark Weber and Ted O'Keefe, and I, too, have studied the Holocaust. And you can kill an awful lot of people in 12 years. Dachau opened in 1933, and it ran until 1945.
What's the death toll of that camp,
12 to 20 concentration camps in Germany during that time. The only one where anybody walked away alive was one called Ravensbrück. And I support Mr. Breitbart. I know he's dedicated, and I know he's a scholar.
Let's talk for a moment about just about Dachau. Simon Wiesenthal himself said in 1975 there were no extermination camps on German soil. The Holocaust story today is that there were six extermination camps: Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, and Chełmno.
And Mauthausen.
No, Mauthausen is now, Mauthausen, ma'am, is now said not to be an extermination camp.
You're saying it.
No, but wait a minute.
I agree with Mr. Breitbart.
Mr. Breitbart.
You should get your facts straight.
Charlene.
The only one that anybody walked away from was Ravensbrück.
There were tens of thousands of survivors at Dachau.
There were tens of thousands of survivors at Mauthausen. There's tens of thousands of survivors of Auschwitz. There's tens of thousands of survivors at Buchenwald.
After 12 years?
Wait a minute. It's now the number...
I'm getting off the phone. I wouldn't even give you the courtesy to talk to you.
All right. Charlene.
Madam, we now know that approximately 30,000 people died in Dachau. The vast majority of these people died during the final months of the war. That's well established. There's no real argument about that point. Mr. Breitbart sort of implied that at the beginning. But what's important is that at the Nuremberg trial of 1945-46, in much of the popular literature, Dachau has been characterized as an extermination camp that's no longer held to be true. Even Simon Wiesenthal has admitted as such. The Holocaust story has changed a great deal over the years. But the importance of these changes is usually not talked about. That is, much so-called evidence, eyewitness testimony and so forth about extermination that was once accepted for these now discredited stories is no more reliable than the evidence that's now accepted.
All right, let's go to Renee calling from Pasadena. Hi, Renee, you're on KFI.
Hi. Good evening, Bill. I'm calling not as a Jew, but as an American Indian. And what I want to do here is to point out the process that's going on here. It's the process of all oppressors. It's the process of Goebbels, where he would repeat the lie and then it became the truth. And it's the process throughout history of discounting human reality and human experience. And that's exactly what Mr. Weber and Mr. O'Keefe are doing. And I think it's... they're very slick in their approach, in their pseudo-intellectual, I think, approach. And in quoting the fringe elements and in putting themselves up as authorities. But nonetheless, I think it's inherently repugnant and I'm outraged at the evil that goes on.
You know, thanks, Renee. You know what's interesting is that there's a gut-level reaction to this. And I have to tell you that I've been listening to all this. Not too many people are coming up with any factual disputes for what you're saying. Most of us don't have the facts at our hands. I certainly don't. That's why Kirk brought up a very good point. I wish that the people from Simon Wiesenthal would be here, because they certainly have facts at their hands and could argue a much more intellectually based argument with you. And I don't know, my guess is you folks have a much better time arguing when people know the facts.
Yes.
You can really get into it.
It's very telling that the people who claim to have the facts refuse to debate with us.
I find that, the emotions run very, very deep here. You're probably talking one of the deepest running emotional subjects that you can think of.
Bill, that's all the more reason why we should be as sober and as factual as we can on this subject.
But I'm fascinated by just the gut level, wrenching reaction of what is going on here. Okay, let's go on and find out if we can find some people who have some refutations, other than just this gut level. And I have the same reaction these people do, gentlemen, I have to tell you. You know, I am upset, I am incensed, I am screaming at you here, inside, going, you know, what the hell are you doing? And I'm not real comfortable with what's happening here.
You've been trained to react that way.
I don't know if I've been trained to react that way. Certainly, I have been conditioned to react that way because of
That's
the information, the information that I have. But the whole world, mainly, I believe, thinks this way. There's a let me go. Go ahead. You had
very few Americans of my generation, or certainly my parents' generation, are stricken with this gut level horror and revulsion when we talk about the mass bombings against civilians of Japan, where whole cities were just laid waste.
Right.
80,000-90,000 people were just cooked in a single night.
The previous speaker talked about propaganda. Well, there's no aspect, no chapter of modern history that is as politicized, as propagandized as the Holocaust extermination story. We have an endless ream of motion pictures, books, movie articles about this aspect of history. As you yourself considered earlier on this program, Stalin's victims vastly outnumber Hitler's, but we don't find anything near the amount of propaganda about that as we do about Hitler's victims.
No one came out. No, because there aren't lots of Russians here who came out of that.
That shouldn't prevent the production of docudramas and miniseries on television.
Let's go to Bob, first-time caller from Lakewood. Bob, you're on KFI.
Hello, Bill. How you doing?
Good.
First of all, I'd like to say that this phenomenon of revisionism is not unique with respect to the Nazis. It also goes on with respect to Stalin's mass murders. There are historians out there like Jerry Howe who have tried to minimize the number of victims of Stalin. There's a debate, I put it in quotation marks, about how many people Stalin killed. I think that this historical revisionism with respect to the number of Nazi victims, this kind of history bears the same relationship to true history as pseudoscience does to science. You know, if you go to the college libraries, you can see books in the physics sections that are titled things like Overthrow Einstein and Reshape Newton's Laws. You look through them and the ordinary civilian or non-scientist, let's say, perhaps can't tell whether or not what he's looking at is science or pseudoscience. Quite a bit has been written in the way of refutation of these Holocaust revisionists that have appeared in magazines that anybody can read at their local library. I'd like to mention a couple of them, if possible.
Sure.
Okay. There's an article called Lies About the Holocaust by the eminent historian of the Holocaust who just died, Lucy DeWittowitz, in the December 1980 issue of Commentary. There's an article called The Denial of the Dead on the Farrison Affair, the French historian, who's not really a historian, he's a professor of literature, that appeared in the journal Dissent, fall 1981. And there's also an article called The Men Who Whitewash Hitler in the British magazine New Statesman, 2 November 1979. Mm. And anybody who's really interested in reading the other side of this can go to their library and read these articles.
I mean, the other side being the traditional view of the Holocaust.
Well, not so much the traditional view of the Holocaust, but an analysis of, as they put it, this worldwide movement to deny that the Holocaust occurred.
Got it.
As so, traditional history says it did, with approximately the number of victims killed in the way that they were killed.
All right, Bob, let me let you go. Real quick, because we have to take a break, Ted.
I would like the gentleman, since he was interested in supplying a bibliography, to name one lie and refute it on the basis of his reading. And I would have liked to ask him if there are many books refuting revisionism in libraries, isn't it just that there should be many revisionist works to consult in those libraries as well?
I want to ask you that about the number of books that are out there when we come back on KFI. This is Bill Handel sitting in for Joe Crummy. We're coming back after this.
KFI AM 640 is 947. Bill Handel sitting in for Joe Crummy. We're discussing historical revisionism, redoing the Holocaust history with Mark Weber, Director of Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, and Ted O'Keefe, the editor, Journal of Historical Review. Both these gentlemen claim that the Holocaust, as we understand it, simply didn't happen. They don't refute there were concentration camps. They don't refute that the Jews were treated horribly. They do refute that 6 million Jews died in the gas chambers and other ways of being killed as a planned effort of the Nazi killing machine of World War II. Ted, did you want to refute the last call, or do you want to take another phone call?
No, I think I spoke to you before we spoke.
Okay, let's go to Marcus, calling from Los Angeles. Marcus, you are on KFI.
Yes, I just wanted to make a couple of quick comments.
Sure.
One is that in terms of the Jewish Holocaust and visited upon them by the Nazis, one thing that the Jewish community has never discussed in a public way is the Zionist complicity in the Nazi Holocaust.
Oh, you want to tell me what the Zionist complicity was in this?
Complicity in the Nazi Holocaust is that they prevented the international worldwide Jewish organizations from intervening into the domestic affairs of Germany at that time, and actually helped facilitate the Nazis in their destruction of the Jews, such that they could get their hands on Palestine.
Okay.
Because the whole entire situation helped them.
All right, Marcus. Mark is nodding his head.
Well, there's a couple of points to be made about that. One point is, first, it is true that Zionist organizations did prevent some of the relief efforts that were possible during the war to help Jews in Europe. That there is some truth to that. Another thing that's quite interesting is the Simon Wiesenthal Center has welcomed to its offices none other than Yitzhak Shamir, the present Prime Minister of Israel. During the 1940s, he was a leading member of the Stern Gang, a major Zionist terrorist group.
Yeah.
Yes, this organization in 1940 actually made an offer of a military alliance with Nazi Germany, because for the Stern Gang and for Yitzhak Shamir, their main enemy was the British, and he was willing to make an offer of collaboration with Nazi Germany during that period of time. Yitzhak Shamir has a long and well-documented record as a terrorist. The Simon Wiesenthal Center considers him a great guy, a person that they rolled out the red carpet for at their organization. They have the audacity to make all sort of criticisms of the IHR when that's their record.
It's important to note, too, that years before the war started, the Nazis and the Zionists had a more or less de facto collaboration whereby tens of thousands of Jews were allowed to immigrate from Germany to Palestine with considerable amounts of capital, which was quite rare for any immigrants during the 1930s, because currency and goods were carefully controlled.
Right. This pact was called the Ha'avara Agreement, or the Transfer Agreement, and
right.
Operated from 1933 until the war prevented it to be carried out, whereby the German and Zionist organizations, the Third Reich and the Jewish Agency, collaborated in the systematic transfer of Jews to Palestine.
Was Germany being paid per person on this transfer?
No.
Was it a money-making scheme by the Nazi government?
No. There was a scheme whereby So the British at that time prevented Jews from immigrating into Palestine if
right.
they didn't have at least £1,000, which was a considerable amount of money at that time. And the Ha'avara Agreement permitted Jews to transfer their money through a rather complicated scheme, which allowed them then to immigrate into Palestine.
Right. Marcus, well, thanks for the call.
Another fallacy that the Jewish community makes is that they speak of the Jewish community as a whole without distinguishing between Ashkenazi Jews, Sephardic Jews, and whatnot. And they also refer to Jews in terms of as if a minority or a race. And I thought that they were more in line of a religious...
Marcus, we're not going to get into the discussion of whether Jews are a religion or a race. Let me tell you, Jews get into that discussion for weeks at a time and can't get into that, so don't worry about that. All right, let's go to Fabria, calling from Encino. It's Fariba, right?
Yes, Fariba.
Hi, Fariba. Welcome to KFI.
Thank you. Ask my question. I have two comments. You called Ishaq Shamir a terrorist. He's not a terrorist. His quote-unquote terrorism was different from like a Palestinian terrorist, because Ishaq Shamir and his friends, they were fighting military men. They weren't fighting...
Wait a minute, ma'am. One of the Shamir's most famous assassinations was the assassination of Count Folke Bernadotte, the Swedish United Nations peace envoy in 1948. He was assassinated because he was working on a peace settlement between the Palestinians and the Israeli Jews at that time, Palestinian Jews at that time. Yitzhak Shamir was also involved in the Deir Yassin, or his organization was involved in the Deir Yassin, a killing of Palestinians in the King David Hotel bombing, and in the assassination in 1944 of Lord Moyne, the British Middle East envoy in Cairo.
I'd like to say that not every country has a Nobel laureate, Menachem Begin, as prime minister, who was succeeded by a man who killed another Nobel laureate, Yitzhak Shamir.
Okay, so if that's the way you handle it, tell me when George Washington was fighting for the independence of America, who did he fight?
British soldiers.
All right. Fariba, yeah, do you have a comment to make other than the questions?
Okay, I want to know, why do these people think that Jews are doing this? Why, if Jews think it was 6 million, I mean, you're saying it's just 1 million. Why do we want to make it 6 million?
All right, won't you answer that question? Can you do that in about 10 or 15 seconds?
Well, the main point, I suppose, here is that as Bill has said and as other speakers have said and we have said, the Holocaust story is a political weapon in our society. It's become as one Jewish American historian, Alfred Lilienthal, calls it Holocaustomania. It's used as a political bludgeon. It's involved with the United States government, with our media.
Ted?
And, of course, there's the point of historical fact. It'd be worthwhile, since one always hears a figure bandied around, to find out what the best estimate of it is.
All right. We're going to come back, and if you want to get hold of Ted or Mark at the Institute of Historical Review, we're going to give you address right here on KFI AM 640. This is Bill Handel. We're coming back. Back here at 9:54, another 6 minutes to go, so we are going to be able to take another few phone calls. But before we do, if anybody wants to get hold of the Institute of Historical Review, how do they do that, Ted? Oh, hang on. Let's get some microphones here. Here we go. You back on?
Yeah. Right.
Can, wait a sec. I can't hear you in my headphones. Julie? I can't. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the Institute for Historical... Can you hear me now, Bill?
Yes.
Yeah, the people who are interested in contacting the Institute for Historical Review can reach us at Post Office Box 1306, 1306, Torrance, California, 90505.
Hey,
Post Office Box 1306, Torrance, 90505.
And
just write IHR over that. IHR, Post Office Box 1306, Torrance, California, 90505.
Okay, P.O. Box...
1306.
1306, Torrance, California. What do you guys do there, by the way? What does the Institute of Historical Review do? Ted?
We publish a quarterly journal. We're just about to come out with our 40th issue. We publish a newsletter 7 times a year. We publish books on not merely the Holocaust, but other historical subjects. And we sell many books published by others.
And a wide variety of audio and videotapes.
Okay,
as well.
Now, are you... involved with political movements of any kind?
No.
You know, we already asked whether you were involved in the Nazi movement at all, and you said no. Are there any other politicized movements left or right wing that you were hooked up with?
No. Historical revision is very heterogeneous. We have libertarians, we have anarchists, we have leftists, we have far rightists, a whole mix.
You don't have many Jews, I'll bet.
There have been, I think, 4 contributors to the Journal of Historical Review over the years.
4 Jewish contributors?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there are... We understand there are Jewish academics who are at least closet Holocaust revisionists.
All right, let's go to another phone call. We still have another 2-3 minutes to go, so I'm going to take David calling from a car phone in Beverly Hills. David, you're on KFI.
Yes, I just want to commend you, gentlemen, on your courage in presenting this, because I'm sure you're getting a lot of flack, because I've noticed in this country, anytime you level any criticism at Israel or Jews, you're immediately called a Nazi and an anti-Semite. That's my comment. And the other question is, and if you haven't answered it, how many German civilians or Germans died in World War II?
All right, thanks for the question.
Yeah, well, most historians say that something like 5.5 million Germans died during the Second World War, were killed during the Second World War. It's interesting that many of them, of course, were killed in bombings of German cities during the war. That is, literally holocausted, literally burned up. An interesting point. But we hear far more, of course, as I mentioned earlier, about the fate of the Jews in Europe during the Second World War than any other single person during the Second World War.
All right, let's go to Daniel calling from Studio City. Daniel, welcome to KFI.
Hi, I have a very brief comment. Something your two guests did earlier, I think, was very, very telling and angered me quite a bit. There was a caller earlier who referred to a document, a Soviet document, I believe it was, which he believed supported the Holocaust theory, and you said at first you were familiar with it. Then he said in the document talked about gas pellets which had such a high nitrate content that they could only be used for extermination, and your two guests just dismissed it. They didn't, ask him to identify the document. They didn't ask him to send them a reprint or whatever.
Sir, I ask him.
I find that you're a couple of pedagogues with an agenda.
Sir, please. I thought, sir.
Hello?
At first, I thought he was referring to some Soviet documents that were made available 2 years ago. That he said that he used this two-year figure. When I ask him, I would like to know what document he is specifically referring to.
Aaron Breitbart would like to know too, because.
Why didn't you ask him for it? I was thinking.
Well, I asked him did ask him what document he was specifically referring to, and he said he didn't know. He couldn't remember exactly.
He did not say he didn't know.
Well, he didn't know. Yes, he did.
You weren't familiar with it,
sir. He said that he didn't remember precisely what document he was referring to. I wish he had been specific. We all wish that.
If he had that proof, sir, it would have been all over the world by now.
Let's go to Pete. Pete calling for the first time from Pasadena. Pete, you got about a minute and a half. Can we do it?
Oh, we'll try.
Okay.
Okay, I find it surprising that these gentlemen claim that there was no governmental policy by the Germans to exterminate the Jews. Real quick, I mean, there are the Journal of Hans Frank, the Governor General of Poland, referring to the necessity of annihilating the Jews. There are quotes by Himmler, an address that he gave at Posen in October of 1943, talking about how among ourselves it should be mentioned quite frankly, and yet we will never speak of it publicly. I mean the extermination of the Jewish race.
All right.
Goes on and
Daniel, I'm going to let them refute, okay, because we got 30 seconds left. He came up with three specific quotes. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, of course, yeah. Well, Himmler's speech is a reference really here to Einsatzgruppen shootings of Jews in Russia. There were large numbers of Jews who were shot as hostages and et cetera in the Soviet Union. Hans Frank specifically said at the Nuremberg trials that he did not know of any extermination of Jews during the Second World War. His diary, it does not say what you say it says. That's, I suppose, a short answer to that.
That's it. We're out of time. It has been an extraordinary 3 hours. I want to thank Mark Weber and Ted O'Keefe of the Institute of Historical Review. Mark, with the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. Ted, editor of the Journal of Historical Review. Aaron Breitbart, senior researcher from the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. And, of course, Eric Braverman, our producer, who I couldn't do this without. He's actually Joe Crummy's producer, but not tonight. And I thank everybody for the phone calls. It has been a very interesting 3 hours, one of the shows that I have felt more personally involved and more in tune with than many other shows that I've been involved with. I will see you on Thursday and Friday night when I sit in for... what's his name? Tom Likas. That's his name. I always forget. I do this to Tom all the time, and I shouldn't. And Saturday morning. Thank you, everybody. Have a good weekend. Bill Handel, KFI, Los Angeles.